Once upon a time, there were four little rabbits.
How old are you, Johnny? She asked.
16.
We few, we happy few, we band of brothers.
It was the best of times. It was the worst of times.
A wise old king once said, of the making of books, there is no end. How true today. Of the overabundance of writing published each year, what's worth reading? The answer is simple. Read only the best. Come join the discussion on Just the Best Literature.
Well, hello again, everyone. Thanks for listening in today. Well, I don't have any comments today, and I'm hoping that's going to change here in the next couple weeks. But today, what I want to do is I want to finish our discussions of chapter Cairo 1914 to 1916. Now, I promised you this last time, but you have to remember I was just a little bit rusty as I was getting back into radio after being off for about 6-7 weeks. So I think I'm back. Classes have begun here at Herbert W. Armstrong College, so I'll be speaking quite a bit. And that'll just keep me in tune for radio. Now, remember, this chapter is important because of its coverage of the history that led to the current crisis in the Middle East. Now, all of you listeners out there, if you really, truly want to understand the Middle East of today, you must know how it was all put together. And it really, this book really does show us how sloppily, in many ways, it was put together. And to be fair, I think we could also say that it was very definitely a very challenging problem to try and, remove one empire and then begin new countries. And so many of us, I think that, have been born after World War II. It's hard for us to relate to some of the things of World War I, even of World War II, because, well, we think history began with us. But the history of these countries really is not that far distant, but it did have some unusual beginnings. Now, the one thing that we have to remember is that T.E. Lawrence did have a major influence in the Middle East formation of today. And it was just quite astounding what he was doing at the age of 27 and 28. Now, this chapter also on Cairo, it really does help us to understand how this gifted archaeological student became a terrorist leader who actually won battles for the British. Now, essentially, he believed he was winning battle for the Arabs, but this chapter really does, I should say it this way, this chapter by Korda really does give us this really insight, deep insight. And he really does a masterful job of tracing Lawrence's progression step by step from being an Oxford archaeological student and then becomes a terrorist leader. And we have to understand that a lot of the terror techniques that people in the Middle East are using through Europe and using, sometimes even in the United States, but these terrorists of today learned a lot of their techniques from Lawrence and what Lawrence did in World War I. And so I don't think it's unfair to call him a terrorist leader, although he was British, and we could really also say he was British military. Now, last time we did talk about the Arab Bureau and the importance of the Arab Bureau. And remember, that was formed in March 1916. And so the thing is, what we have to understand about that Arab Bureau, now, even though Lawrence didn't become a member of that Bureau until October of 1916, it really is that Bureau that put Lawrence in the limelight and did propel him into combat. But I just want to read you this quote again from page 283. And again, Korda just does a great job of summing these things up for us. But as we get to the end of this chapter, we're getting closer and closer to Lawrence giving up his job as intelligence, maybe we could say intelligence leader, to becoming a warrior. And it really is kind of fascinating. And again, this is an important quote. It says, Lawrence was thus in regular touch with the intelligence service of all the allied nations, and indeed was sent to Athens on a quick trip to help straighten out matters there. So when Korda is speaking here, he's actually talking about the time before Lawrence became a member of the Allied Bureau. So Hogarth was really working hard to keep him involved. And here he's being sent to straighten matters out in Athens. Now, there is a great benefit to what he did there. I'm going to continue now. It says, as for the Russians who were fighting the better part of the Turkish regular army in the Caucasus, Lawrence apparently reached out on his own on the basis of information obtained from the interrogation of the Arab deserter from the Turkish forces at Al-Faruqi to put the Grand Duke Nicholas in touch with certain disaffected Turkish officers in Erzurum, thus making possible the successful Russian assault on this important fortress town in February 1916. So we can learn something there about Lawrence. And it's really important that we get it, is this young man was not afraid to break out on his own. And it was very frustrating to the leaders, I should say some of the leaders above him, that he didn't necessarily always feel like obligated to go to, to those in command. But when he did some things like he did, there was always a success. And so that's something very special we need to learn about Lawrence. Korda goes on to say, these were deep waters and confirm the fact that Lawrence was not only being treated as a wonder kind by his superiors in Cairo and in London, but also being encouraged or at any rate allowed to expand his reach in every direction. So you can see that certainly as a young person, he had a lot of people on his side. Obviously, Hogarth was on his side. Even Gertrude Bell at some point got on his side. And essentially, whether they knew what was happening or not, they were advancing him step by step into leaving intelligence and becoming a warrior, or becoming the soldier he always wanted to become. Now, I think it's also important for you to remember, as we close this chapter, that it's around the same time when the Arab Bureau was being established in March 1916 that everything began to happen with the Arabs, and the start of the Arab revolt, it all began to fall into place. And of course, this is something that Lawrence was really waiting for and really wanting and desiring to happen. But the 50,000 pounds in gold coins had been paid to Sharif Hussein around the same time. There was a large stockpile of rifles and ammunition was being begun at Port Sudan. So they were beginning to stockpile all the rifles and the ammunition they had promised the Arabs. The British force in Egypt and the British Mediterranean Expeditionary Force were combined under General Murray. Now remember that British Mediterranean Expeditionary Force, they were the survivors of the disaster at Gallipoli, or the Dardanelles, as we've talked about in previous programs with Winston Churchill. Now, they were combined under General Murray, who was just a very effective general. Now, essentially what also happened at this time is Murray began, having so many troops now together, he began building roads and pipelines to supply water into the desert. That was going to be crucial for them to be able to fight against the Turks in the desert. Now, what all this meant is actually the Arab revolt had begun, and this was long awaited. Now, remember now, Lawrence, even though he's an intelligence officer, he has taken all these facts that he's learned from intelligence, and he's actually manipulating them for his own use. And can you think about this man, this young man? Now, here he is, a military genius. He has access to all these facts, and what he was doing is he was pulling them together in his own mind for a great game plan. Now, I've been reading some other books related to this recently, and other people that knew him, he had his enemies, T.E. Lawrence did, and they thought he was given too much to imagination. But when you look at the success he had, you can see that he could pull a plan together and achieve it. Now, The next thing I think that we need to really talk about towards the end of this chapter, and we need to talk about this disaster at Kut El Amara. Now, if you remember way back when we were starting to talk about Aqaba, I mean, this is back to chapter 2, is Korda does mention Kut in the very beginning, and he does talk about, you know, Lawrence and his role there. But we have to understand that even this disaster, and it really was a disaster at Kut, and what Lawrence was able to do there is really, I would think that this disaster is what helped propel him even more into being a combatant, because he was actually taken into something that, you know, was actually military oriented. He was taken in, you know, on the team that was going to go and try and bribe, you know, the Turks to let General Townsend, you know, to go free. And so it really it's something that we need to just talk about. And again, you have to remember this started in December. I think it was around December 7th, 1915, and about Townsend and what he was really going to do. Now, this story is told in this book on pages 287 to 290. So I'm going to quote some of this to you because it is really important that we get it. And again, we just have to remember this is probably more than anything. Now, all the intelligence gathering was important. I mean, Lawrence really did show himself quite a genius in being able to analyze things. But it's probably this disaster that propelled him into the military more than anything else, and really quite unexpected to him. You know, he didn't expect this, and but this is what really drove it. So let me just kind of cover some facts with you. Go back over the facts. So, and again, maybe some of this will come together for you. So this whole disaster at Kut, or it's Kut El Amara. If you wanted to look on a map, you can see it on a map today, and it's in that area of Iraq. And, you know, it's in this area where they had the Anglo-Indian Army. And if you remember back to some of our previous discussions, we've talked about how you had the Cairo belief of how things should happen in the Middle East. You had the Delhi belief of how things should happen in the Middle East. You had, the British Empire from India. They brought their Anglo-Indian Army into the Middle East. You had, you know, the men from Britain in the army in the Middle East, and there was this tension between these two groups. And so again, that really did work against them anyway. But the thing is this Major General Charles Townsend was over this Anglo-Indian Army. And essentially what he wanted to do is he wanted to go from Basra, and he wanted to go north with the intention of taking Baghdad. And again, remember, this is all under the Ottoman Empire at that time. And I mean, these names are still, I mean, these are real places today, Basra and Baghdad. And so what they're trying to do is they're trying to wrestle this away from the Ottoman Empire. Of course, the Anglo-Indian Army wanted to wrestle it away from the Ottoman Empire in order to get a good handle on the grains that were produced there, because India needed those grains. And so Charles Townsend was really, really eager to take Baghdad. Now, he came very close to doing it, but what was really surprising to all of them is that, if you remember very early on, we talked about how the British just believed the Turks were terrible soldiers and they had no ability to do anything. Well, they learned that they were pretty responsive. So again, Townsend almost took Baghdad, but then, you know, they just couldn't complete the task. Now, of course, you know that when that happens, the military leader is going to be blamed. So even in history, people wonder why Townsend just didn't keep fighting. But it just seems like, he was exhausted. His forces were exhausted. there is this length of communication all the way back to Basra, and it just seems like, you know, they just couldn't get the job done. And, you know, he didn't move forward. And that's still a question in history. Why didn't he move forward? Now, again, there's many different opinions about why he didn't go forward. But one of the things we have to know is fighting in the desert, fighting in that area. Remember now, Kut Al-Amara is on the Tigris River. So there's great humidity there. And, you know, essentially, when he was at Baghdad, he had about 30,000 men. But then by the time, let's say, you know, we're getting into, let's say, after December, we're getting into early 1916, you know, his troops had been reduced to half. And many of them were dying because of their wounds from fighting, but they were also dying from sickness. And they essentially what they did is they started to retreat away from Baghdad, and they went back to Kut Al-Amara. And, you know, so that area around Kut, it was just very humid. It was very hot. They had what they call the stinging black flies. I remember we've talked about that, about Lawrence. He didn't care about those stinging black flies. You know, he could just, he would be eaten up by it and not bothered. But there was also malaria carrying mosquitoes there. And so, I mean, they were really, really in a strait. They were really in a bad way. Now, this Kalil Pasha, again, we've talked about him in previous programs. Now, he was this Ottoman warrior. His uncle, Enver Pasha, was the minister of war for the Ottoman Empire. And essentially what they did is they got their forces together, and they made three attacks on Kut. And, you know, so they did not give up. They weren't people that would give up just quickly. And so the British had to learn a really tough lesson there. And so essentially what happened, they couldn't take the British force, but what they did is they laid siege to the town, and they began to cut off their supplies. And, of course, you know, it was getting worse all the time, and Townsend wanted to surrender. And that would have been an absolute disaster. And if he would have done an unconditional surrender with you know, Indian forces, that we had both Anglo and Indian forces, it would have been horrible for the Indian soldiers, because the Turks would have just brutalized them in their war camps. So no one wanted that. And so if they could prevent them being forced marched into Turkish prisons, that's what they wanted. And so of course, Townsend got Kitchener involved, and they decided that they wanted to negotiate with Kalil Pasha. And essentially what they were going to do, they were going to offer him $1 million bribe to let Townsend and his forces go. And so that's what they had to do. And of course, I think we've talked about this before. So they had to bring someone from Parliament in. Mark Sykes' friend Aubrey Herbert was chosen, but then amazingly they chose Lawrence to accompany Herbert because he spoke Arabic. So again, here's this another situation for Lawrence, that it just seems like he shows up at the right place at the right time, and so they send him in to be able to speak Arabic, you know, with Pasha. But it turns out they have the meeting in French, and guess who speaks French fluently? Well, it's T.E. Lawrence. And so it just seems like, you know, Lawrence always ended up in the right place at the right time. And it's almost like you can see this unseen hand is moving him closer and closer to becoming a warrior. So essentially, They send Lawrence ahead up the Tigris to meet with this guy. with Khalil Pasha, and then Herbert follows him behind. One of the bad things is Lawrence, you know, gets bitten by the mosquitoes, and brings his malaria back. He gets sick, and they get into these meetings, and of course Khalil Pasha was very nice to them, and of course he was impressed with Lawrence's French. He turned down the $1 million or the £1 million of bribe, and then they decided to offer him $2 million, and eventually went to $3 million, and it just didn't work out. And so it was a great learning experience for Lawrence, but it really turned out to be a disaster. It was the greatest loss. It was considered the greatest Allied loss in World War I. And of course, they didn't get what they wanted. And Townsend was set free, and some of his leaders. Well, maybe I shouldn't say set free. They were put on an island. But the other people were walked. The other soldiers were walked to the British. I mean, not to the British, to the Turkish prisoner of war camps, and they were just brutalized. Here's what Lawrence, his view of that. It says, Lawrence was sickened by conditions around Kut. It combined all the horrors of trench warfare on the Western Front with humid, intense heat, unburied bodies, and dense clouds of biting insects, and by sheer futility of what was doing there. Townsend troops were forced marched across the desert to indescribably brutal prisoner of war camps, preyed on by raiding Arabs along the way. Nearly three-quarters of the British troops and half of the Indian troops would be worked or starved to death in captivity, whereas Townsend himself was held in luxurious quarters on a villa on the island of Malacca. And so there you have, it just seemed like the British were just failing, on every effort. And so by the summer of 1916, it was really kind of bad, for the British, and they really needed to do something. Now, we have to remember again that once Lawrence returned, back to his desk, he was really, really very excited that the revolt had begun. And he even wrote home to his mother. He said, "This revolt," he wrote home, "will be the biggest thing in the Near East since 1550. And so he was really excited what was going to be happening. Now, the only other thing that was going on at that time is, remember, the Arabs were now trying to take Medina. And this is on page 293 if you want to keep following it. And they had to face 14,000 Turkish troops. And again, the Turks weren't so disorganized as everybody thought they were. So it's at this time then that Lawrence is back in his office. He was complaining horror of what happened, with trying to do the bribe. And then he was complaining so much about how ineffective the British military was. But he didn't realize that once he was back home, it was only going to be about 48 hours that he'd be on his way to Jeddah. And then just 9 days later, stores would be saying goodbye to Lawrence at Rabah. And then Lawrence would ride into the desert and for his first meeting with Faisal. So we've already covered that in Chapter 2. Well, that's all the time we have for today's program. Next time, we'll begin our discussion of Chapter 1917, The Uncrowned King of Arabia. Remember, for this current series of programs, we are using Michael Korda's book, Hero, The Life and Legend of Lawrence of Arabia. You can buy this book at Amazon.com. You can find a used copy of the book at abebooks.com. And, of course, you can also check your local library. So please write me any comments you may have to jbl@pcog.org. You can follow JBL on Twitter at jbliterature1. You can also follow JBL on Facebook. Simply search for Just the Best Literature. And so until next time, keep reading.
You've been listening to Just the Best Literature on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, streaming online at kpcg.fm and thetrumpet.com.